I have to go, he said. His white cloth jacket was on the foot of the bed. He picked it up and slung it over his shoulder.
You ain't no nice guy, she cried at him as he went into the living room. I only went with you because I thought you were a nice guy.
The sight of the living room made him groan inwardly. On the couch, where he dimly remembered being gobbled, were at least 24 copies of Baby Can You Dig Your Man. 3 more were on the turntable of the dusty portable stereo. On the far wall was a huge poster of Ryan O'Neill and Ally McGraw. Being gobbled means never having to say you're sorry. Ha ha. Jesus, I am going crazy. She stood in the bedroom doorway, still crying, pathetic in her half-slip. He could see a nick on one of her shins where she had cut herself shaving.
Listen, give me a call, she said. I ain't mad.
He should have said, sure, and that would have been the end of it. Instead, he heard his mouth utter a crazy laugh, and then, your kippers are burning. Larry got out quickly and pounded down the stairs. As he went down the last 6 steps to the front door, he heard her in the upstairs hall yelling down,
you ain't no nice guy. You ain't no...
He slammed the door behind him, and misty, humid warmth washed over him, with it the smell of spring trees and automobile exhaust. It was perfume after the smell of frying grease and stale cigarette smoke. He still had the crazy cigarette, now burned down to the filter, and he threw it into the gutter and took a deep breath of the fresh air. Wonderful to be out of that craziness. Return with us not to those wonderful days of normalcy as we... Above and behind him, a window went up with a rattling bang, and he knew what was coming next.
I hope you rot, she screamed down at him. I hope you fall in front of some fucking subway train. You ain't no singer. You're shitty in bed, you louse. Take this to your mother, you louse.
A milk bottle came zipping down from her second-floor bedroom window. Larry ducked. It went off in the gutter like a bomb, spraying the street with glass fragments. A scotch bottle came next, twirling end over end, to crash nearly at his feet. Whatever else she was, her aim was terrifying. He broke into a run, holding one arm over his head. This madness was never going to end. From behind him came a final, long, braying cry, triumphant with juicy Bronx intonation.
Kiss my ass, you cheap bastard!
Then he was around the corner and on the expressway overpass, leaning over, laughing with a shaky intensity that was nearly hysteria, watching the cars pass below. Couldn't you have handled that better? He said, totally unaware that he was speaking out loud. Oh, man, you could have done better than that. That was a bad scene, crap on that man. He realized he was speaking aloud, and another burst of laughter escaped him. He suddenly felt a dizzy, spinning nausea in his stomach and squeezed his eyes tightly closed. A memory circuit clicked open, and he heard Wayne Stuckey saying, there's something in you that's like biting on tinfoil. He had treated the girl like an old whore on the morning after the frat house gangbang. You ain't no nice guy. I am, I am. But when the people at the big party had protested his decision to cut them off, he had threatened to call the police, and he had meant it. Most of them were strangers, true. He could care if they crapped on a landmine. But 4 or 5 of the protesters had gone back a ways. And Wayne Stuckey, that bastard, standing in the doorway with his arms folded like a judge or something. Sal Doria going out saying, if this is what it does to guys like you, Larry, I wish you were still playing sessions. He opened his eyes and turned away from the overpass, looking for a cab. Oh, sure. The outraged friend bit. If Sal was such a big friend, what was he doing there sucking the cream in the first place? I was stupid, and nobody likes to see a stupid guy wise up. That's the real story. You ain't no nice guy. I am a nice guy, he said sulkily. And whose business is it anyway? A cab was coming, and Larry flagged it. The chemical bank building on Park, he said, climbing in. You got a cut on your forehead, guy, the cabbie said. A girl threw a spatula at me, Larry said absently. The cabbie offered him a strange false smile of commiseration and drove on. leaving Larry to settle back and try to imagine how he was going to explain his night out to his mother. Chapter 11. The red light went on. The pump hissed. The door opened. The man who stepped through was not wearing one of the white all-over suits, but a small, shiny nose filter that looked a little bit like a two-pronged silver fork, the kind the hostess leaves on the canapé table to get the olives out of the bottle. "Hi, Mr. Redman," he said, strolling across the room. He stuck out his hand, clad in a thin, transparent rubber glove, and Stu, surprised into the defensive, shook it. "I'm Dick Dietz. Denninger said you wouldn't play ball anymore unless somebody told you what the score was." Stu nodded. "Good," Dietz said, and sat on the edge of the bed. He was a small brown man, and sitting there with his elbows cocked just above his knees, he looked like a gnome in a Disney picture. "So what do you want to know?" "First, I guess I want to know why you're not wearing one of those spacesuits." "Because Geraldo there says you're not catching." Dietz pointed to a guinea pig behind the two-panel glass window. The guinea pig was in a cage, and standing behind the cage was Denninger himself, his face expressionless. "Geraldo, huh?" "Geraldo's been breathing your air for the last 3 days via convector. This disease that your friends have passes easily from humans to guinea pigs and vice versa. If you were catching, we figured Geraldo would be dead by now." "But you're not taking any chances," Stu said dryly, and cocked a thumb at the nose filter. "That," Dietz said with a cynical smile, "is not in my contract." "What have the others got?" "I'm sorry, that's classified." "How did that fellow Campion get it?" "That's classified, too." "My guess is that he was in the army, and there was an accident someplace, like what happened to those sheep in Utah, only a lot worse." "Mr. Redman, I could go to jail just for telling you you were hot or cold." Stu rubbed a hand thoughtfully over his new scrub of beard. "You should be glad we're not telling you more than we are," Dietz said. "You know that, don't you?" "So I can serve my country better," Stu said dryly. "No, that's strictly Denninger's stick," Dietz said. "In the scheme of things, both Denninger and I are little men, but Denninger is even littler than I am. He's a servo motor, nothing more. There's a more pragmatic reason for you to be glad. You're classified too, you know. You've disappeared from the face of the earth. If you knew enough, the big guys might decide that the safest thing would be for you to disappear forever." Stu said nothing. He was stunned. "But I didn't come here to threaten you. We want your cooperation very badly, Mr. Redman. We need it. Where are the other people I came in here with?" Dietz brought a paper out of an inside pocket. "Victor Palfrey, deceased. Norman Bruett, Robert Bruett, deceased. Thomas Wanamaker, deceased. Ralph Hodges, Bert Hodges, Cheryl Hodges, deceased. Christian Ortega, deceased. Anthony Leominster, deceased." The names reeled in Stu's head. Chris the bartender. He'd always kept a sawed-off, lead-loaded Louisville slugger under the bar, and the trucker who thought Chris was kidding about using it was apt to get a big surprise. Tony Leominster, who drove that big international with the Cobra CB under the dash, sometimes hung around Hap Station, but hadn't been there the night Campion took out the pumps. Vic Palfrey? Christ, he had known Vic his whole life. How could Vic be dead? But the thing that hit him the hardest was the Hodges family. "All of them?" he heard himself ask. "Ralph's whole family?" Dietz turned the paper over. "No, there's a little girl, Eva, 4 years old. She's alive." "Well, how is she?" "I'm sorry, that's classified." Rage struck him with all the unexpectedness of a sweet surprise. He was up, and then he had hold of Dietz's lapels, and he was shaking him back and forth. From the corner of his eye, he saw startled movement behind the double-paned glass. Dimly, muffled by distance and soundproofed walls, he heard a hooter go off. "What did you people do?" he shouted. "What did you do? What in Christ's name did you do? Mr. Redman, huh? What the fuck did you people do?" The door hissed open. 3 large men in olive drab uniforms stepped in. They were all wearing nose filters. Dietz looked over at them and snapped, "Get the hell out of here!" The three men looked uncertain. "Our orders, get out of here, and that's an order!" They retreated. Dietz sat calmly on the bed. His lapels were rumpled, and his hair had tumbled over his forehead. That was all. He was looking at Stu calmly, even compassionately. For a wild moment, Stu considered ripping his nose filter out, and then he remembered Geraldo, what a stupid name for a guinea pig. Dull despair struck him like cold water. He sat down. "Crashed in a sidecar," he muttered. "Listen to me," Dietz said. "I'm not responsible for you being here. Neither is Denninger or the nurses who come in to take your blood pressure. If there was a responsible party, it was Campion, but you can't lay it all on him either. He ran, but it was a technical slip-up that allowed him to run. The situation exists. We are trying to cope with it, all of us. But that doesn't make us responsible." "Then who is?" "Nobody," Dietz said, and smiled. "On this one, the responsibility spreads in so many directions that it's invisible. It was an accident. It could have happened in any number of other ways."
"Some accident," Stu said, his voice nearly a whisper.
"What about the others?
Hap and Hank Carmichael and Lila Bruette, their boy Luke, Monty Sullivan?"
"Classified," Dietz said. "Gonna shake me some more? If it will make you feel better, shake away." Stu said nothing, but the way he was looking at Dietz made Dietz suddenly look down and begin to fiddle with the creases of his pants.
"They're alive," he said, "and you may see them in time."
"What about Arnett?"
"Quarantined."
"Who's dead there?"
"Nobody."
"You're lying."
"Sorry you think so."
"When do I get out of here?"
"I don't know."
"Classified?"
Stu asked bitterly.
"No, just unknown." "You don't seem to have this disease. We want to know why you don't have it. Then we're home free."
"Can I get a shave? I itch."
Dietz smiled.
"If you'll allow Denninger to start running his tests again, I'll get an orderly in to shave you right now."
"I can handle it. I've been doing it since I was 15.
Dietz shook his head firmly.
"I think not."
Stu smiled dryly at him.
"Afraid I might cut my own throat?"
"Let's just say..." Stu interrupted him with a series of harsh, dry coughs. He bent over with the force of them. The effect on Dietz was galvanic. He was up off the bed like a shot and across to the airlock with his feet seeming not to touch the floor at all. Then he was fumbling in his pocket for the square key and ramming it into the slot.
"Don't bother," Stu said, smiling. "I was faking."
Dietz turned to him slowly. Now his face had changed. His lips were thinned with anger, his eyes staring.
"You were what?"
"Faking," Stu said. His smile broadened. Dietz took two uncertain steps toward him. His fists closed, opened, then closed again.
"But why? Why would you want to do something like that?"
"Sorry," Stu said, smiling. "That's classified."
"You shit son of a bitch," Dietz said with soft wonder.
"Go on," Stu said. "Go on out and tell them they can do their tests." He slept better that night than he had since they had brought him here. And he had an extremely vivid dream. He had always dreamed a great deal. His wife had complained about him thrashing and muttering in his sleep. But he had never had a dream like this. He was standing on a country road at the precise place where the black hot top gave up to bone-white dirt. A blazing summer sun shone down. On both sides of the road there was green corn, and it stretched away endlessly. There was a sign, but it was dusty and he couldn't read it. There was the sound of crows, harsh and far away. Closer by, someone was playing an acoustic guitar, finger-picking it. Vic Palfrey had been a picker, and it was a fine sound.
"This is where I ought to get to," Stu thought dimly. "Yeah, this is the place, all right. What was that tune? Beautiful Zion? The fields of my father's home? Sweet by and by?" Some hymn he remembered from his childhood, something he associated with full immersion and picnic lunches. But he couldn't remember which one. Then the music stopped.
A cloud came over the sun. He began to be afraid. He began to feel that there was something terrible, something worse than plague, fire, or earthquake. Something was in the corn and was watching him. Something dark was in the corn. He looked and saw two burning red eyes far back in the shadows, far back in the corn. Those eyes filled him with the paralyzed, hopeless horror that the hen feels for the weasel. Him, he thought. The man with no face. Oh, dear God. Oh, dear God, no. Then the dream was fading, and he awoke with feelings of disquiet, dislocation, and relief. He went to the bathroom, and then to his window. He looked out at the moon. He went back to bed, but it was an hour before he got back to sleep. All that corn, he thought sleepily. Must have been Iowa, or Nebraska, maybe northern Kansas. But he had never been in any of those places in his life. It was 2 minutes to midnight. Patty Greer, the nurse who had been trying to take Stu's blood pressure when he went on strike, was leafing through the current issue of McCall's at the nurse's station and waiting to go in and check Mr. Sullivan and Mr. Hapscom. Hap would still be awake watching Johnny Carson and would be no problem. He liked to josh about how hard it would be to pinch her bottom through her white all-over suit. Mr. Hapscom was scared, but he was being cooperative, not like that dreadful Stuart Redman, who only looked at you and wouldn't say boo to a goose. Mr. Hapscom was what Patty Greer thought of as a good sport. As far as she was concerned, all patients could be divided into two categories, good sports and old poops. Patty, who had broken a leg roller skating when she was 7 and had never spent a day in bed since, had very little patience with the old poops. You were either really sick and being a good sport, or you were a hypochondriac making trouble for a poor working girl. Mr. Sullivan would be asleep, and he would wake up ugly. It wasn't her fault that she had to wake him up, and she would think Mr. Sullivan would understand that. He should just be grateful that he was getting the best care the government could provide, and all free at that. And she would just tell him so if he started being an old poop tonight again. The clock touched midnight. Time to get going. She left the nurse's station and walked down the hallway toward the white room, where she would first be sprayed and then helped into her suit. Halfway there, her nose began to tickle. She got her hanky out of her pocket and sneezed lightly 3 times. She replaced the handkerchief. Intent on dealing with cranky Mr. Sullivan, she attached no significance to her sneezes. It was probably a touch of hay fever. The directive in the nurses' stations, which said in big red letters, "Report any cold symptoms, no matter how minor, to your supervisor at once," never even crossed her mind. They were worried that whatever those poor people from Texas had might spread outside the sealed rooms. But she also knew it was impossible for even a tiny virus to get inside the self-contained environment of the white suits. Nevertheless, on her way down to the white room, she infected an orderly, a doctor who was just getting ready to leave, and another nurse on her way to do her midnight rounds. A new day had begun. Chapter 12. A day later, on June 23rd, a big white Connie was roaring north on U.S. 180 in another part of the country. It was doing somewhere between 90 and 100, its Corinthian white paint job glittering in the sun, the chrome winking. The opera windows in the rear also gave back the sun, heliographing it viciously. The trail that Connie had left behind was wandering and pretty much senseless. Up 81 to U.S. 80, the turnpike, until Polk and Lloyd began to feel nervous. They had killed 6 people in the last 6 days, including the owner of the Continental, his wife, and his daughter. But it was not the 6 murders that made them feel antsy about being on the interstate. It was the dope and the guns. 5 grams of hash, a little tin snuff box filled with God knew how much coke, and 16 pounds of marijuana. Also, 2.38s, 3.45s, a 357 mag that Polk called his pokerizer, 6 shotguns, 2 of them sawed-off pumps, and a Schmeisser submachine gun. Murder was a trifle beyond their intellectual reach, but they both understood the trouble they were going to be in if the Arizona State Police picked them up in a stolen car full of blow and shooting irons. On top of everything else, they were interstate fugitives, had been ever since they crossed the Nevada border. Interstate fugitives. Lloyd Henry liked the sound of that. Gangbusters. Take that, you dirty rats. Have a lead sandwich, you lousy copper. So they had turned north at Deming, now on 180. Had gone through Hurley and Bayard and the slightly larger town of Silver City, where Lloyd had bought a bag of burgers and 8 milkshakes. Why in the name of Christ had he bought 8 of the motherfuckers? They would soon be pissing chocolate. Grinning at the waitress in an empty yet hilarious way that made her nervous for hours afterward. I believe that man would just as soon have killed me as looked at me, she told her boss that afternoon. Past Silver City and roaring through Cliff, the road now bending west again, just the direction they didn't want to go in. Through Buckhorn, and then they were back in the country God forgot. 2-lane blacktop running through sagebrush and sand, buttes and mesas in the background, made you want to puke. We're getting low on gas, Polk said. Wouldn't be if you didn't drive so fucking fast, Lloyd said. He took a sip of his 3rd milkshake, gagged on it, powered down the window, and threw out all the leftover crap, including the 3 milkshakes neither of them had touched. Whoop, whoop, Polk cried. He began to goose the gas pedal. The Connie lurched forward, dropped back, lurched forward. Ride 'em, cowboy, Lloyd yelled. Whoop, whoop. You want smoke? Smoke 'em if you got 'em, Polk said. Whoop, whoop. There was a large green hefty bag on the floor between Lloyd's feet. It was holding 16 pounds of marijuana. He reached in, got a handful, and began to roll up a bomber joint. Whoop, whoop. The Connie cruised back and forth over the white line. Cut the shit, Lloyd shouted. I'm spilling it everywhere. Plenty more where that came from. Whoop! Come on, man, we gotta sell this stuff, man. We gotta deal this stuff or we gonna get caught and wind up in somebody's trunk. Okay, sport. Polk began to drive smoothly again, but his expression was sulky. It was your idea, your fucking idea. You thought it was a good idea. Yeah, and I didn't know we'd end up driving all over fucking Arizona either. How are we ever gonna get to New York this way? We're throwing off pursuit, man. Lloyd said. In his mind, he saw police garage doors opening and thousands of 1940s radio cars issuing forth into the night, spotlights crawling over brick walls. Come on out, Canarsie. We know you're in there. Good fucking luck, Polk said, still sulking. We're doing a hell of a job. You know what we got besides that dope and the guns? We got 16 bucks and 300 fucking credit cards we don't dare use. What the fuck? We don't even have enough cash to fill this hog's gas tank. God will provide, Lloyd said, and spit-sealed the bomber. He lit it with the Connie's dashboard lighter. Happy fucking days. And if you want to sell it, what are we doing smoking it? Polk went on, not much mollified by the thought of God providing. So we sell a few short ounces. Come on, Polk, have a smoke. This never failed to break Polk up. He brayed laughter and took the joint. Between them, standing on its wire stock, was the Schmeisser fully loaded. The Connie blazed on up the road, its gas gauge standing at an 1/8. Polk and Lloyd had met a year before in the Brownsville Minimum Security Station, a Nevada work farm. Brownsville was 90 acres of irrigated farmland and a prison compound of Quonset huts about 60 miles north of Tonopah and about 80 northeast of Gabs. It was a mean place to do short time. Although Brownsville Station was supposed to be a farm, nothing much grew there. Carrots and lettuce and peas got one taste of that blaring sun, chuckled weakly, and died. Legumes and weeds would grow, and the state legislature was frantically dedicated to the idea that someday soybeans would grow. But the kindest thing that could be said about Brownsville's ostensible purpose was that the desert was taking a Christless long time to bloom. The warden, who preferred to be called the boss, prided himself on being a hard-ass, and he hired only men he considered to be fellow hard-asses. And, as he was fond of telling the new fish, Brownsville was mostly minimum security because there was no place to run to if you went under the wire. Some did, but most were brought back in 2 or 3 days, sunburned, glare-blind, and eager to sell the boss their shriveled raisin souls for a drink of water. Some of them cackled madly, and one young man, who was out for 3 days, claimed he saw a large castle some miles south of Gabs, a castle with a moat. The moat, he said, was guarded by trolls riding big black horses. Some months later, when a Colorado revival preacher did a show at Brownsville, the same young man got Jesus in a big way. Andrew Polk Freeman, in for simple assault, was released in April of 1980. He had occupied a bed next to Lloyd Henreid and had told him that if Lloyd was interested in a big score, he knew about something interesting in Vegas. Lloyd was willing. Lloyd was released on June 1st. His crime, committed in Reno, had been attempted rape. The lady was a showgirl on her way home, and she had shot a load of tear gas into Lloyd's eyes. He felt lucky to get only 2 to 4, plus time served, plus time off for good behavior. At Brownsville, it was just too fucking hot to misbehave. He caught a bus to Las Vegas, and Polk met him at the terminal. "This is the deal," Polk told him. He knew this fellow, one-time business associate, might describe him best, and this guy was known in certain circles as Gorgeous George. He did some piecework for a group of people with mostly Italian and Sicilian names. George was strictly part-time help. What he did mostly for these Sicilian-type people was to take things and bring things. Sometimes he took things from Vegas to L.A. Sometimes he brought other things back from L.A. to Vegas. Small-time dope, mostly, freebies for big-time customers. Sometimes guns. The guns were always a bring, never a take. As Polk understood it, and Polk's understanding never got much beyond what the movie people call soft focus, these Sicilian-type people sometimes sold iron to independent thieves. Well, Polk said, Gorgeous George was willing to tell them the time and place when a fairly good haul of these items were in stock. George was asking 25% of what they realized. Polk and Lloyd would crash in on George, tie him and gag him, take the stuff, and maybe give him a couple of biffs and baffs for good measure. It had to look good, George had cautioned, because these Sicilian-type people were no one to fool around with. Yeah, Lloyd said. That sounds good. The next day, Polk and Lloyd went to see Gorgeous George, a mild-mannered six-footer with a small head which sat incongruously above his roof-beam shoulders. He had a full head of waved blonde hair, which made him look a bit like the famed wrestler. He had had second thoughts about the deal, but Polk had changed his mind again. Polk was good at that. George told them to come around to his house the following Friday evening around 6. Wear masks, for God's sake, he said. And you bloody my nose and black my eye, too. Jesus, I wish I'd never gotten into this. The big night came. Polk and Lloyd took a bus to the corner of George's street and put on ski masks at the foot of his walk. The door was locked, but as George had promised, not too tightly locked. There was a rumpus room downstairs, and there was George standing in front of a hefty bag full of pot. The ping-pong table was loaded down with guns. George was scared. Jesus, oh Jesus, I wish I'd never gotten into this, he kept saying as Lloyd tied his feet with clothes rope and Polk bound his hands with Scotch brand filament tape. Then Lloyd biffed George in the nose, blooding it, and Polk baffed him in the eye, blacking it as per request. Jeez, George cried, did you have to do it so hard? Polk plastered a piece of adhesive tape across George's mouth. The two of them had begun to gather up the swag. You know something, old buddy? Polk said, pausing. Nope, Lloyd said, giggling nervously. Not a thing. I wonder if old George there can keep a secret. Lloyd stared thoughtfully at Gorgeous George for a long, hard minute. George's eyes bugged back at him in sudden terror. Then Lloyd said, Sure, it's his ass, too. But he sounded as uneasy as he felt. Polk smiled. Oh, he could just say, Hey, guys, I met this old friend and his buddy. We shot the shit for a while, had a few beers, and what do you think? The sons of bitches came over to the house and ripped me off. Sure hope you catch them. Here's what they look like. George was shaking his head wildly, his eyes capital O's of terror. The guns were in a heavy canvas laundry sack they had found in the downstairs bathroom. Now Lloyd hefted the bag nervously and said, Well, what do you think we ought to do? I think we ought to pokerize him, old buddy, Polk said regretfully. Only thing we can do. Lloyd said, That seems awful hard after he put us onto this. Hard world, old buddy. Yeah, Lloyd sighed, and they walked over to George. George said, shaking his head wildly.
Woof, woof, woof.
I know, Polk soothed him. Bitch, ain't it? I'm sorry, George, no shit. Catch on his head, Lloyd.
That was easier said than done. Gorgeous George was whipping his head wildly from side to side. He was sitting in the corner of his rumpus room, and the walls were cinder block, and he kept rapping his head against them. Didn't even seem to feel it.
Catch him, Polk said serenely, and ripped another piece of tape from the roll.
Lloyd at last got him by the hair and managed to hold him still long enough for Polk to slap the second strip of adhesive neatly across George's nose, thereby sealing all his tubes. George went purely crazy. It went on for almost 5 minutes before George was completely still. He bucked and scrabbled and thumped. His face got as red as the side of old Dad's barn. The last thing he did was to lift both legs 8 or 10 inches straight up off the floor and bring them down with a crash. It reminded Lloyd of something he had seen in a Bugs Bunny cartoon or something, and he chuckled a little, feeling a bit cheered up. Up until then, it had been sort of gruesome to see. Polk squatted beside George and felt for his pulse.
Well, Lloyd said. Nothing ticking but his watch, old buddy, Polk said. Speaking of which.
He lifted George's meaty arm and looked at his wrist.
Nah, just a Timex.
He let George's arm drop, shattering the crystal. George's car keys were in his front pants pocket, and in an upstairs cupboard they found a Skippy peanut butter jar half-filled with dimes, and they took those, too. There was $20.60 in dimes. George's car was a wheezy old Mustang with bald tires. They left Vegas on U.S. 93 and went southeast into Arizona. By noon of the next day, day before yesterday, they had skirted Phoenix on the back roads. Yesterday, around 9, they had stopped at a dusty old general store 2 miles beyond Sheldon on Arizona Highway 75. They knocked over the store and pokerized the proprietor, an elderly gentleman with mail-order false teeth. They got $63 and the old man's pickup truck. The pickup truck had blown 2 tires this morning. They had crossed the state line from Arizona into New Mexico earlier on, and they stood by the truck, not sure what to do next. Along had come the White Continental and solved all their problems. The driver pulled over, leaned out, and said, "Need any help?" "Sure do," Polk had said, and pokerized the guy right on the spot. Got him dead bang between the eyes with the .357 mag. Poor sucker probably never even knew what had hit him. "Why don't you turn here?" Lloyd said, pointing to the junction coming up. He was pleasantly stoned. "Sure could," Polk said cheerfully. He let the Connie's speed drop from 80 to 60, drifted it to the left, right wheels barely leaving the ground, and then a new piece of road was unrolling in front of them. Route 78, due west. And so, not knowing they had ever left it, or that they were now the perpetrators of what the newspapers were calling a tri-state kill spree, they re-entered Arizona. About an hour later, a sign came up on their right. Burak 6. "Burlap?" Lloyd said foggily. "Burak," Polk said, and began twisting the Connie's wheel so that the car made big, graceful loops back and forth across the road. "Whoop, whoop." "You want to stop there? I'm hungry, man." "You always hungry. Fuck you, when I get stoned, I get the munchies." "You can munch my 9-inch hog leg, how's that? Whoop, whoop." "Seriously, Polk, let's stop." "Okay. Gotta get some cash, too. We've thrown off enough fucking pursuit. We gotta get some money and shag ass north. This desert shit makes no sense to me." "Okay," Lloyd said. He didn't know if it was the dope working on him or what, but all of a sudden he felt paranoid as hell, even worse than when they'd been on the turnpike. Polk was right. Stop outside this barrack and pull a score like they had outside of Sheldon. Get some money and some gas station maps. Ditch this fucking Connie for something that would blend into the scenery. Then get going north and east by the secondary roads. Get the fuck out of Arizona. "I'll tell you the truth, man. All of a sudden I feel as nervous as a long-tailed cat in a room full of rocking chairs." "I know what you mean, Jelly Bean," Lloyd said gravely. And then it hit them both funny and they broke up. Burak was a wide place in the road. They shot through it, and on the other side was a combination cafe, store, and gas station.
There was an old Ford wagon and a dust-streaked Olds with a horse trailer behind it in the dirt parking lot. The horse stared out at them as Polk wheeled the Connie in.
"This looks like just the ticket," Lloyd said.
Polk agreed. He reached into the back for the 357 and checked the loads.
"You ready?"
"I guess so," Lloyd said, and took hold of the Schmeisser. They walked across the baked parking lot. The police had known who they were for 4 days now. They had left their fingerprints all over Gorgeous George's house, and in the store where the old man with the mail-order dentures had been pokerized. The old man's pickup had been found within 50 feet of the bodies of the three people who belonged with the Continental, and it seemed reasonable to assume that the men who had killed Gorgeous George and the store owner had also killed these three. If they had been listening to the Connie's radio instead of the tape player, they would have known that Arizona and New Mexico police were coordinating the largest manhunt in 40 years, all for a couple of small-time grifters who could not quite comprehend what they might have done to start such a fuss. The gas station was self-service. The clerk had to turn on the pump. So they went up the steps and inside. Three aisles of canned goods went up the room toward the counter. At the counter, a man in cowboy clothes was paying for a pack of smokes and half a dozen Slim Jims. Halfway down the middle aisle, a tired-looking woman with coarse black hair was trying to decide over two brands of spaghetti sauce. The place smelled of stale licorice and sun and tobacco and age. The proprietor was a freckled man in a gray shirt. He was wearing a company cap that said Shell in red letters against a white field. He looked up as the screen door slapped shut, and his eyes widened. Lloyd put the wire stock of the Schmeisser against his shoulder and fired a burst at the ceiling. The two hanging light bulbs shattered like bombs. The man in the cowboy clothes began to turn around.
"Just hold still and nobody'll get hurt,"
Lloyd shouted, at which point Polk made him a liar by blowing a hole through the woman looking at the sauces. She flew out of her shoes.
"Holy gee, Polk," Lloyd hollered. "You didn't have to pokerize her, old buddy,"
Polk yelled.
"She'll never watch Lawrence Welk again. Whoop, whoop."
The man in the cowboy clothes kept turning. He was holding his smokes in his left hand. The harsh light falling through the show window and the screen door pricked out bright stars in the dark lenses of his sunglasses. There was a .45 revolver tucked into his belt, and now he plucked it out unhurriedly as Lloyd and Polk were staring at the dead woman. He aimed, fired, and the left side of Polk's face suddenly disappeared in a spray of blood and tissue and teeth.
"Shot!"
Polk screamed, dropping the .357 and pinwheeling backward. His flailing hands raked potato chips and taco chips and cheese doodles onto the splintery wooden floor.
"Shot me, Lloyd! Look out! Shot me! Shot me!"
He hit the screen door and banged back through it and sat down hard on the porch outside, pulling one of the aged door hinges loose. Lloyd, stunned, fired more in reflex than in self-defense. The Schmeisser's roar filled the room. Cans flew. Bottles crashed, spilling catsup, pickles, olives. The glass front of the Pepsi cooler jingled inward. Bottles of Dr. Pepper and knee-high and Orange Crush exploded like clay pigeons. Foam ran everywhere. The man in the cowboy clothes, cool, calm, and collected, fired his piece again. Lloyd felt rather than heard the bullet as it droned by, nearly close enough to part hair. He raked the Schmeisser across the room from left to right. The man in the shell cap dropped behind the counter with such suddenness that an observer might have thought a trap door had been sprung on him. A gumball machine disintegrated. Red, blue, and green chews rolled everywhere. The glass bottles on the counter exploded. One of them had contained pickled eggs, and immediately the room was filled with the sharp odor of vinegar. The Schmeisser put three bullet holes in the cowboy's khaki shirt, and most of his innards exited from the back to splatter a Budweiser sign that showed the world-famous Clydesdales. The cowboy went down, still clutching his .45 in one hand and his deck of luckies in the other. Lloyd, bullshit with fear, continued to fire. The machine pistol was growing hot in his hands. A box filled with returnable soda bottles tinkled and fell over. A calendar girl wearing hot pants took a bullet hole in one magical peach-colored thigh. A rack of paperbacks with no covers crashed over. Then the Schmeisser was empty, and the new silence was deafening. The smell of gunpowder was heavy and rank.
"Holy gee," Lloyd said.
He looked cautiously at the cowboy. It didn't look like the cowboy was going to be a problem.
Shot me,
Poke brayed, and staggered back inside. He clawed the screen door out of his way with such force that the other hinge popped and the screen fell off onto the porch.
Shot me, Lloyd, look out!
I got him, Poke, Lloyd soothed, but Poke seemed not to hear. He was a mess. His right eye blazed like a baleful sapphire. The left was gone. His left cheek had been vaporized, and you could watch his jaw work on that side as he talked. Most of his teeth were gone over there, too. His shirt was soaked with blood.
Stupid fuck blew me up,
Poke screamed. He bent over and got the .357 mag.
I'll teach you to shoot me, you numb fuck.
He advanced on the cowboy, a rural Dr. Sardonicus. He put one foot on the cowboy's butt like a hunter posing for a picture with his trophy and prepared to empty the .357 into his head. Lloyd stood watching, gape-mouthed, the smoking machine pistol dangling from one hand, still trying to figure out how all of this had happened. At that moment, the man in the shell cap popped back up from behind the counter, his face screwed up in an expression of desperate intent, a double-barreled shotgun clutched in both hands. Huh? Poke said, and looked up just in time to get both barrels. Lloyd decided it was time to leave. Fuck the money. There was money everywhere. He wheeled and exited the store in large, shambling strides, his boots barely touching the boards. He was halfway down the steps when an Arizona State Police cruiser wheeled into the yard. A trooper got out on the passenger side and pulled his pistol. Hold it right there. What's going on in there? Three people dead, Lloyd cried. Hell of a mess. Guy that did it went out the back. I'm getting the fuck out. He ran to the Connie and had actually slipped behind the wheel when the trooper yelled, Halt! Halt or I'll shoot! Lloyd halted. The keys weren't in the fucking thing anyway. Holy gee, Lloyd said miserably, as one of the troopers laid a big horse pistol upside his head. The other one cuffed him. In the back of the cruiser, sonny. The man in the shell cap had come out onto the porch, still clutching his shotgun.
He shot Bill Markson, he yelled in a high, queer voice. T'other one shot Mrs. Storm. Hell of a note. I shot t'other one. He's dead on a shitbug. Like to shoot this one, too, if you boys'll stand away.
Calm down, Pop, one of the troopers said. Fun's over.
I'll shoot him where he stands, the old guy yelled. I'll lay him low.
Then he leaned forward like an English butler making a bow and threw up on his shoes.
You boys get me away from that guy, would you? Lloyd said. I think he's crazy.
You got this coming out of the store, you hairbag, the other trooper said. The barrel of his pistol looped up and up, catching the sun, and then it crashed down on Lloyd Henreid's head, and he never woke up until that evening in the Apache County Jail's infirmary. Chapter 13. Nick opened the door between Sheriff Baker's office and the jail cells, and they started razzing him right off. Vincent Hogan and Billy Warner were in the two saltine box cells on Nick's left. Mike Childress was in one of the two on the right. The other was empty, and it was empty because Ray Booth, he of the purple LSU fraternity ring, had flown the coop.
Hey, dummy, Childress called. Hey, you fucking dummy. What's going to happen to you when we get out of here, huh? Answer me that. What the fuck you think's going to happen to you?
I'm personally going to rip your balls off and stuff them down your throat until you strangle on them, Billy Warner told him. You understand me?
Only Vince Hogan didn't participate in the razzing. Mike and Billy didn't have too much use for him on this day, June 23rd, when they were to be taken up to the Calhoun County seat and jugged pending trial. Sheriff Baker had leaned on old Vince, and old Vince had spilled his yellow guts. Baker had told Nick he could get an indictment against these boys, but when it got to a jury trial, it was going to be Nick's word against these three, four if they picked up Ray Booth. Nick lowered his head so he couldn't see their lips and went on sweeping. He was careful to keep to the center of the aisle, out of reach of their hands. He had gained a healthy respect for Sheriff John Baker. At 250 pounds, he was Big John to his constituents. The respect was not just because he had given Nick this swamper's job to make up for his week's lost pay, but because he had gone after the four men who had beaten Nick up,
as if the victim had been the oldest resident in town instead of a drifter passing through. There were sheriffs in the border south, Nick knew, who would have been happy to see him onto the county work farm instead. They had driven out to the sawmill where Vince Hogan worked, in Baker's private car. He had a bubble light in the glove box that he put on the dash when he was on business. It was up there when they had gone out on the morning of the 21st. Baker had hawked, spat out the window, and dabbed at his watery eyes. His voice had acquired a nasal foghorning quality, which Nick, of course, couldn't hear. "When we see him," Baker said, "I'm going to grab him by the arm. I'll ask you, is this one of them? I don't care if you saw him or not. You just nod yes. Get it?" Nick nodded. He got it. Vince was working on the board planer, standing in sawdust almost to the tops of his work boots. His eyes flicked uneasily to Nick standing beside the sheriff, and he gave Baker a nervous smile. "Hi, Big John. What you doing out with the working folk?" The other men were watching, their eyes shifting from Nick to Vince to Baker in a kind of continuous triple play. One of them spat a stream of red man into the sawdust and wiped his chin deliberately with the heel of his hand. Baker grabbed Vince by one flabby, sunburned arm and dragged him forward. "Hey," Vince said nervously. "Why you pulling on me, Big John?" Baker turned to Nick. "Is this one of them?" Nick nodded firmly and pointed at Vince. "Hey," Vince protested. "I don't know this dummy from Adam." "Then how you so sure he's a dummy? Come on, Vince. You can send one of these old boys for your toothbrush. March." Protesting, Vince had been led to the cruiser and deposited inside. He was taken back to Shoyo, locked up, and left to stew for a couple of hours. When Baker came back in around noon, Vince was hungry and scared. He had spilled everything. Mike Childress was in the jug by 1 o'clock, and Billy Warner was found at his house as he was packing up his old Ford to go somewhere. A long piece from the look of all the suitcases and cartons. Baker had taken Nick home to meet his wife and have some supper. In the car on the way over, Baker had told Nick that she was bearing up under the news that her brother Ray had been involved in the assault. "She knows you can't pick your relatives like you do your friends," he said. Jane Baker was a small, pretty woman who made Nick welcome, but her eyes were red and socketed from weeping. "I'm pleased to know you, Nick," she said, taking his hand, "and I apologize deeply for your trouble." Nick shrugged awkwardly and waved it away. "I offered him a job around the place," Baker said. "It's gone to hell since Bradley moved to Little Rock, painting and picking up mostly. He's going to have to stick around anyway for the, trial, yes," she said. There was a moment of silence, painful even to Nick. Then, with forged gaiety, she said, "I hope you can eat country ham, Nick. That's what there is, along with potato salad. My potato salad's never up to what his mother made. That's what he says." Nick patted his stomach and smiled. Over the strawberry shortcake dessert, Jane said, "You've been taking too much on, John Baker. Your cold's worse, and you didn't eat." Baker looked guiltily at his plate, then shrugged. "I can afford to miss one now and then," he said, and palpitated his double chin. "You're flush, too. Fever?"
"Maybe a touch."
"Well, you're not gone out tonight, that's all." "My dear, I have prisoners. If they don't need to be watched, they at least need to be fed and watered." "Nick can do that," she said with finality. "You're going to bed."
"I can't do that," he said weakly. "He isn't a deputy."
"Well, you just deputize him. He ain't a resident." "I won't tell if you won't," she said firmly. She began clearing the table. "You just go on and do it." And that was how Nick Andros went from Shoyo prisoner to Shoyo deputy in less than 24 hours. As he was preparing to go up to the sheriff's office, Baker came into the downstairs hall, looking large and ghostly in a frayed bathrobe. He seemed a little embarrassed to be seen in such attire.
"I shouldn't have let her talk me into this," he said. "Wouldn't have if I didn't feel so punk. My chest's all clogged up, and I'm as hot as a fire sale. Weak, too."
Nick nodded sympathetically.
"I'm stuck between deputies. Bradley Cade and his wife went up to Little Rock after their baby died. One of those crib deaths. Awful thing. I don't blame them for going. Nick pointed at his own chest and made a circle with his thumb and forefinger. Sure, you'll be okay. You just take normal care, you hear? There's a .45 in the third drawer of my desk, but don't you be taking it back there, nor the keys either, understand? If you go back there, stay out of their reach. If any of them tries playing sick, don't you fall for it. It's the oldest dodge in the world. If one of them should get sick, Doc Soames can see them just as easy in the morning. I'll be in then. Nick took his pad from his pocket and wrote, I appreciate you trusting me. Thanks for locking them up and thanks for the job. Baker read this carefully. You're a pure decaution, boy. Where are you from? How come you're out on your own like this? That's a long story, Nick jotted. But I'll write some of it down for you tonight if you want. You do that, Baker said. I guess you know I put your name on the wire. Nick nodded. It was SOP, but he was clean. I'll get Jane to call Ma's truck stop out by the highway. Those boys will be hollering police brutality if they don't get their supper. Nick wrote, Have her tell whoever brings it to come right in. I can't hear him if he knocks. Okay. Baker hesitated a moment longer. You got your cot in the corner. It's hard, but it's clean. You just remember to be careful, Nick. You can't call for help. Nick nodded and wrote, I can take care of myself. Yeah, I believe you can. Still, I'd get someone from town if I thought any of them would. He broke off as Jane came in. You still jarring this poor boy? You let him go on now before my stupid brother comes along and breaks them all out. Baker laughed sourly. He'll be in Tennessee by now, I guess. He whistled out a long sigh that broke up into a series of phlegmy, booming coughs. I believe I'll go upstairs and lie down, Janie. I'll bring you some aspirin to cut that fever, she said. She looked back over her shoulder at Nick as she went to the stairs with her husband. It was a pleasure meeting you, Nick, whatever the circumstances. You be just as careful as he says. Nick bowed to her, and she dropped half a curtsy. He thought he saw a gleam of tears in her eyes. A pimply, curious boy in a dirty busboy's jacket brought three dinner trays about half an hour after Nick had gotten down to the jail. Nick motioned for the busboy to put the trays on the cot, and while he did, Nick scribbled, Is this paid for? The busboy read this with all the concentration of a college freshman tackling Moby Dick. Yeah, he said. Sheriff's office runs a tab. Say, can't you talk? Nick shook his head. That's a bitch, the busboy said, and left in a hurry, as if the condition might be catching. Nick took the trays in one at a time and pushed each one through the slot in the bottom of the cell door with a broom handle. He looked up in time to catch, Chicken shit bastard, ain't he? From Mike Childress. Smiling, Nick showed him his middle finger. I'll give you the finger, you dummy, Childress said, grinning unpleasantly. When I get out of here, I'll... Nick turned away, missing the rest. Back in the office, sitting in Baker's chair, he drew the memo pad into the center of the blotter, sat thinking for a moment, and then jotted at the top, Life History by Nick Andros. He stopped, smiling a little. He had been in funny places, but never in his wildest dreams had he expected to be sitting in a sheriff's office, deputized, in charge of three men who had beaten him up, and writing his life story. After a moment, he began to write again. I was born in Caslin, Nebraska, on November 14, 1958. My daddy was an independent farmer. He and my mom were always on the edge of getting squeezed out. They owed three different banks. My mother was 6 months pregnant with me, and my dad was taking her to see the doctor in town when a tie rod on his truck let go and they went into the ditch. My daddy had a heart attack and died. Anyway, 3 months after, my mom had me and I was born the way I am. Sure was a tough break on top of losing her husband that way. She carried on with the farm until 1963 and then lost it to the big operators, as she always called them. She had no family, but wrote to some friends in Big Springs, Iowa, and one of them got her a job in a bakery. We lived here until 1967, when she was killed in an accident. A man on a motorcycle hit her while she was crossing the street on her way home from work. It wasn't even his fault, but only bad luck as his brakes failed. He wasn't even speeding or anything. The Baptist Church gave my mama a charity funeral. This same church, the Grace Baptist, sent me to the Children of Jesus Orphanage in Des Moines. This is a place that all sorts of churches chip together to support. That was where I learned to read and write. He stopped there. His hand was aching from writing so much, but that wasn't why. He felt uneasy, hot and uncomfortable at having to relive all that again. He went back to the jail quarters and looked in. Childress and Warner were asleep. Vince Hogan was standing by the bars, smoking a cigarette and looking across the corridor at the empty cell where Ray Booth would have been tonight if he hadn't run so quick. Hogan looked as if he might have been crying, and that led him back in time to that small, mute scrap of humanity, Nick Andros. There was a word he had learned at the movies as a kid. That word was incommunicado. It was a word that had always had fantastic, Lovecraftian overtones to Nick. A fearful word that echoed and clanged in the brain. A word that inscribed all the nuances of fear that live only outside the sane universe and inside the human soul. He had been incommunicado all his life. He sat down and reread the last line he'd written. That was where I learned to read and write. But it hadn't been as simple as that. He lived in a silent world. Writing was code. Speech was the moving of lips, the rise and fall of teeth, the dance of a tongue. His mother had taught him to read lips and had taught him how to write his name in struggling, sprawling letters. "That's your name," she had said. "That's you, Nicky." But of course, she had said it silently, meaninglessly. The prime connection had come when she tapped the paper, then tapped his chest. The worst part about being deaf-mute was not living in the silent movie world. It was not knowing the names of things. He had not really begun to understand the concept of naming until he was 4. He had not known that you called the tall green things trees until he was 4. He had wanted to know, but no one had thought to tell him, and he had no way to ask. He was incommunicado. When she died, he had retreated almost all the way. The orphanage was a place of roaring silence where grim-faced, thin boys made fun of his silence. 2 boys would run up to him, one boy with his hands plastered over his mouth, one boy with his hands plastered over his ears. If none of the staff happened to be near, they would punch him out. Why? No reason. Except that maybe in the vast white class of victims, there are subclasses, the victims of victims. He stopped wanting to communicate, and when that happened, the thinking process itself began to rust and disintegrate. He began to wander from place to place vacantly, looking at the nameless things that filled the world. He watched groups of children in the play yard move their lips, raise and lower their teeth like white drawbridges, dance their tongues in the ritual mating of speech. He sometimes found himself looking at a single cloud for as long as an hour at a time. Then Rudy had come, a big man with scars on his face and a bald head. 6 feet, 5 inches tall, might as well have been 20 to runty Nick Andros. They met for the first time in a basement room where there was a table, 6 or 7 chairs, and a TV that only workmen had felt like it. Rudy squatted, putting his eyes on approximately the same level as Nick's. Then he took his huge, scarred hands and put them over his mouth, his ears. "I am a deaf mute." Nick turned his face sullenly away. "Who gives a fuck?" Rudy slapped him. Nick fell down. His mouth opened and silent tears began to leak from his eyes. He didn't want to be here with this scarred troll, this boogie. He was no deaf-mute. It was a cruel joke. Rudy pulled him gently to his feet and led him to the table. A blank sheet of paper was there. Rudy pointed at it, then at Nick. Nick stared back sullenly and shook his head. Rudy nodded and pointed at the empty paper again. He produced a pencil and handed it to Nick. Nick put it down as if it were hot. He shook his head. Rudy pointed at the pencil, then at Nick, then at the paper. Nick shook his head. Rudy slapped him again. More silent tears. The scarred face looking at him with nothing but deadly patience. Rudy pointed at the paper again, at the pencil, at Nick. Nick grasped the pencil in his fist. He wrote the four words that he knew, calling them forth from the cobwebby, rusting mechanism that was his thinking brain. He wrote, "Nicholas Andros, fuck you." Then he broke the pencil in half and looked sullenly and defiantly at Rudy. But Rudy was smiling. Suddenly, he reached across the table and held Nick's head steady between his hard, calloused palms. His hands were warm, gentle. Nick could not remember the last time he had been touched with such love. His mother had touched him like that. Rudy removed his hands from Nick's face. He picked up the half of the pencil with the point on it. He turned the paper over to the blank side. He tapped the empty white space with the tip of the pencil and then tapped Nick. He did it again, and again, and suddenly Nick understood. "You are this blank page." Nick began to cry. Rudy came for the next 6 years, where I learned to read and write. A man named Rudy Sparkman came to help me. I was very lucky to have him. In 1974, the orphanage went broke. They placed as many kids as they could, but I was not one of them. They said I would get placed with a family and the state would pay them for keeping me. I wanted to go with Rudy, but Rudy was in Africa working for the Peace Corps. So I ran away. Being 16, I don't think they looked for me too hard. I figured if I could stay out of trouble, I would be all right. And so far, so good. I've been taking the high school correspondence courses one at a time because Rudy always said education is the most important. When I settle down for a while, I'm going to take that high school equivalency test. I will be able to pass it soon. I like school. Maybe I will go to college someday. Well, that's my story. On the morning of June 22nd, yesterday, Baker came in around 7:30 while Nick was emptying waste baskets. The sheriff looked better. "How you feeling?" Nick wrote. "Pretty good. I was burning up until midnight. Worst fever I've had since I was a kid. Aspirin didn't seem to help it. Janie wanted to call the doc, but around 12:30 the fever just broke. I slept like a log after that. How you doing?" Nick made a thumb and forefinger circle. "How's our guests?" Nick opened and closed his mouth several times in a mime jabbering. Looked furious, made banging gestures on invisible bars. Baker threw back his head and laughed, then sneezed several times. "You ought to be on TV," he said. "Did you write your life story down like you said you was gonna?" Nick nodded and handed the two sheets of longhand over. The sheriff sat down at his desk and read them carefully. When he was done, he looked at Nick so long and so piercingly that Nick stared down at his feet for a moment, embarrassed and confused. When he looked up again, Baker said, "You've been on your own since you were 16? For 6 years?" Nick nodded. "And you've really taken all these high school courses?" Nick wrote for some time on one of the memo sheets. "I was way behind because I started to read and write so late. When the orphanage closed, I was just starting to catch up. I got 6 HS credits from there and another 6 since then from LaSalle in Chicago. I need 4 more credits." "What courses do you still need?" Baker asked. Nick wrote, "Geometry, advanced math, 2 years of a language. Those are the college requirements." "A language? You mean like French, German, Spanish?" Nick nodded. Baker laughed and shook his head. "Don't that beat all? A deaf mute learning to talk a foreign language. Nothing against you, boy. You understand that." Nick smiled and nodded. "So why you been drifting around so much?" "While I was still a minor, I didn't dare stay in one place for too long," Nick wrote. "Afraid they'd try to stick me in another orphanage or something. When I got old enough to look for a steady job, times got worse."
"Most places would just let you ramble on," Baker said. "In hard times, the milk of human kindness don't flow so free, Nick. I might be able to put you onto something around here. Unless those boys soured you on Shoyo in Arkansas for good. But we ain't all like that. Nick nodded to show he understood that. How's your teeth? Nick shrugged. Take any of those pain pills? Nick held up two fingers. Well, look, I got some paperwork to do on those boys. You go with what you're doing. We'll talk some more later. Dr. Soames, the man who had almost hit Nick with his car, came by around 9:30 a.m. that same morning. He was a man of about 60 with shaggy white hair and a scrawny chicken neck and very sharp blue eyes.
Big John tells me you read lips, he said. He also says he wants to see you gainfully employed, so I guess I better make sure you're not going to die on his hands. Take off your shirt.
Nick unbuttoned his blue work shirt and took it off. Holy Jesus, look at him, Baker said.
They worked him over pretty good, all right.
Soames looked at Nick and said dryly,
Boy, you almost lost your left tit.
He pointed to a crescent-shaped scab just above the nipple. Nick's belly and rib cage looked like a Canadian sunrise. Soames poked and prodded him and looked carefully into the pupils of his eyes. At last he examined the shattered remains of Nick's front teeth, the only part of him that really hurt now, in spite of the spectacular bruises.
That must have hurt like a son of a bitch, he said,
and Nick nodded ruefully.
You're gonna lose him,
Soames went on. You... He sneezed three times in quick succession. Excuse me. He began to put his tools back into his black bag.
The prognosis is favorable, young man, barring strokes of lightning or further trips to Zach's gin mill. Is your speaking problem physical, or does it come from being deaf?
Nick wrote, No vocal cords, no eardrums. Soames nodded.
Classic birth defects. It's a shame. Thank God that he didn't decide to give your brains a stir while he was at it. Put your shirt on.
Nick did. He liked Soames. In his way, he was very much like Rudy Sparkman, who told him once that God had given all deaf-mute males an extra 2 inches below the waist to make up for what he had taken away above the collarbones. Soames said,
I'll tell him to give you a refill on that pain medication down at the drugstore. Tell Moneybags here to pay for it.
Ho, ho, John Baker said.
He's got more dough stashed away in fruit jars than a hog has warts,
Soames went on. He sneezed again, wiped his nose, rummaged around in his bag, and brought out a stethoscope.
You won't look out, Gramps. I'll lock you up for drunk and disorderly, Baker said with a smile.
Yeah, Soames said.
You'll open your mouth too wide one day and fall right in. Take off your shirt, John, and let's see if your boobs are as big as they used to be.
Take off my shirt? Why?
Because your wife wants me to look at you, that's why. She thinks you're a sick man, and she doesn't want you to get any sicker. God knows why. Ain't I told her enough times that she and I wouldn't have to sneak around anymore if you were underground? Come on, Johnny, strip it off.
It was just a cold, Baker said, reluctantly unbuttoning his shirt. I feel fine this morning. Honest to God, Ambrose, you sound worse than I do.
You don't tell the doctor tells you, Soames said.
As Baker pulled his shirt off, Soames turned to Nick and said, But you know it's funny how a cold will just start making the rounds. Mrs. Lathrop is down sick, and the whole Ritchie family, and most of those no-accounts out on the Barker Road are coughing their brains out. Even that Billy Warner in there.
Baker had wormed out of his undershirt.
They're what I tell you, Soames said conversationally. Hasn't he got a set? Even an old shit like me could get horny looking at that.
Baker gasped as the stethoscope touched his chest.
Jesus, that's cold. What do you do, keep it in a deep freeze?
Breathe in, Soames said, frowning. Let it out. Baker let it out, and his exhale turned into a weak cough. Soames kept at the sheriff's of his right hand into the flesh of Baker's neck under the jaw. Baker winced away from it.
I don't have to ask if that hurt, Soames said. John, go home and go to bed.
Baker blinked.
Am, he said quietly, you know I can't do that. I've got 3 prisoners who have to go up to Camden this afternoon. I left this kid with him last night, but I won't do it again. He's mute. I wouldn't have agreed to it last night if I'd been thinking right. You've got some kind of respiratory infection, a damn good one by the sound, and a fever. Your pipes are sick, Johnny. And to be perfectly frank, that's no joke for a man who's carrying around the extra meat you are. Go to bed. If you still feel okay tomorrow morning, get rid of them then. Better still, call the state patrol to come down and get them. Baker looked apologetically at Nick. You know, he said, I do feel kind of dragged out. Maybe some rest. Go home and lie down, Nick wrote. I'll be careful. Besides, I have to earn enough to pay for those pills. Nobody works so hard for you as a junkie, Soames said, and burst out laughing. Baker picked up the two sheets of paper with Nick's background on them. Could I take these home for Janie to read? She took a real shine to you, Nick. Nick scrawled on the pad. Sure can. She's very nice. One of a kind, Baker said, and sighed as he buttoned his shirt back up. This fever's coming on strong again. Thought I had it licked. Take aspirin, Soames said, latching his bag. It's that glandular infection I don't like. There's a cigar box in the bottom desk drawer, Baker said. It's petty cash. You can go out for lunch and get your medication on the way. Those boys aren't what I'd call desperados. Just leave a voucher for how much you take. I'll get in touch with the state police, and you'll be shut of them by late this afternoon. Nick made a thumb and forefinger circle. I've been trusting you a lot on short notice, Baker said soberly. But Janie says it's all right. You have a care. Nick nodded. Jane Baker came in around 6 yesterday evening with a covered dish supper and a carton of milk. Nick wrote, Thanks very much. How's your husband? She laughed, a small woman with chestnut brown hair, dressed prettily in a checked shirt and faded jeans. He wanted to come down himself, but I talked him out of it. His fever was up so high this afternoon that it scared me, but it's almost down to normal tonight. I think it's because of the state patrol. Johnny's never really happy unless he can be mad at the state patrol. Nick looked at her quizzically. They told him they couldn't send anybody down for his prisoners until 9 tomorrow morning. They've had a bad sick day, 20 or more troopers out. And a lot of the people who are on have been fetching people up to the hospital at Camden or even Pine Bluff. There's a lot of this sickness around. I think Am Soames is a lot more worried than he's letting on. She looked worried herself. Then she took the two folded sheets of memo paper from her breast pocket. This is quite a story, she said quietly, handing the papers back to him. You've had just about the worst luck of anybody I ever heard of. I think the way you've risen above your handicaps is admirable. And I have to apologize again for my brother. Nick, embarrassed, could only shrug. I hope you'll stay on and show you, she said, standing. My husband likes you, and I do too. Be careful of those men in there. I will, Nick wrote. Tell the sheriff I hope he feels better. I'll take him your good wishes. She left then, and Nick passed a night of broken rest, getting up occasionally to check on his three wards. He dreamed oddly, and all he could remember upon waking was that he seemed to have been walking through endless rows of green corn, looking for something, and terribly afraid of something else that seemed to be behind him. Chapter 14. It had been so long since Larry had been in Times Square that he had expected it to look different somehow, magical. Things would look smaller and yet better there, and he would not feel intimidated by the rank, smelly, and sometimes dangerous vitality of the place the way he had as a child, when he and Buddy Marks, or just he alone, would scutter down there to see the 99-cent double features, or to stare at the glittering junk in the windows of the arcades and shops and pinball hangouts. But it all looked just the same, more than it should have, because some things really had changed. When you came up the stairs from the subway, the newsstand that had been on the corner as you came out was gone. Half a block down, where there had been a penny arcade full of flashing lights and bells and dangerous-looking young men with cigarettes dangling from the corners of their mouths as they played the Gottlieb Desert Isle or Space Race,
Where that had been, there was now an orange Julius with a flock of young blacks standing in front of it, their lower bodies moving gently as if somewhere jive played on and on, jive that only black ears could hear. There were more massage parlors and X-rated movies. Still, it was much the same, and this made him sad. In a way, the only real difference made things seem worse. He felt like a tourist here now. But maybe even native New Yorkers felt like tourists in the square, dwarfed, wanting to look up and read the electronic headlines as they marched around and around up there. He couldn't tell. He had forgotten what it was like to be a part of New York, and he didn't want to relearn. His mother hadn't gone to work that morning. She'd been fighting a cold for the last couple of days and had gotten up early this morning with a fever. He had heard her from the narrow, safe bed in his old room, banging around in the kitchen, sneezing and saying shit under her breath, getting ready for breakfast. The sound of the TV being turned on, then the news on the Today program. An attempted coup in India. A power station blown up in Wyoming. The Supreme Court was expected to hand down a landmark decision having to do with gay rights. By the time Larry came out into the kitchen, buttoning his shirt, the news was over, and Jean Shalit was interviewing a man with a bald head. The man with the bald head was showing a number of small animals he had hand-blown. Glassblowing, he said, had been his hobby for 40 years, and his book would be published by Random House. Then he sneezed. "Excuse you," Jean Shalit said, and chuckled. "You want them fried or scrambled?" Alice Underwood asked. She was in her bathrobe. "Scrambled," Larry said, knowing it would do no good to protest the eggs. In Alice's view, it wasn't breakfast without eggs, which she called cackleberries when her humor was good. They had protein and nutrition. Her idea of nutrition was vague but all-encompassing. She kept a list of nutritious items in her head, Larry knew, as well as their opposite numbers. Jujubes, pickles, Slim Jims, the slice of pink bubblegum that came with the baseball cards. He sat down and watched her make the eggs, pouring them into the same old black skillet, stirring them with the same wire whisk that she had used to stir his eggs when he had been going to the first grade at PS 162. She pulled her hanky out of her bathrobe pocket, coughed into it, sneezed into it, and muttered, "Shit," indistinctly into it before putting it back. "Day off, Mom?" "I called in sick. This cold wants to break me. I hate to call in sick on Fridays. So many do, but I've got to get off my feet. I'm running a fever. Swollen glands, too." "Did you call the doctor?" "When I was a charming maid, doctors made house calls," she said. "Now, if you're sick, you have to go to the hospital emergency room. Unless you know you're going to be sick a week ahead of time, of course, and then you can make an appointment in advance." She smiled mordantly. "That hospital emergency room. I went there a year ago when I had my inner ear infection. It was worse than the Green Stamp Redemption Center a week before Christmas. And full of Puerto Ricans. I'll stay home and drink juice and take aspirin. I'll feel okay tomorrow." He stayed most of the morning, trying to help out. He lugged the TV in by her bed, the cords standing out heroically on his arms. "You're going to give yourself a hernia so I can watch Let's Make a Deal," she sniffed. Brought her juice and an old bottle of NyQuil for her stuffiness, and ran down to the market to get her a couple of paperbacks. After that, there wasn't much for them to do except get on each other's nerves. She marveled over how much poorer the TV reception was in the bedroom, and he had to bite back an acid comment to the effect that it was better than none at all. Finally, he said he might go out and see some of the city. "That's a good idea," she said with obvious relief. "I'm going to take a nap. You're a good boy, Larry." So he had gone down the narrow stairs, the elevator was still broken, and onto the street, feeling guilty relief. The day was his, and he still had $200 in cash. But now, in Times Square, he didn't feel so good. He wandered along, his wallet long since transferred to a front pocket. He paused in front of a discount record store, transfixed by the sound of his own voice coming from the battered overhead speakers. The bridge verse. "I didn't come to ask you to stay all night, or to find out if you've seen the light. I didn't come to make a fuss or pick a fight. I just want you to tell me if you think you can, baby, can you dig your man? Dig him, baby. Baby, can you dig your man?" "That's me," he thought, looking vacantly in at the albums.
But today the sound depressed him. Worse, it made him homesick. He didn't want to be here under this dirty gray washed-up sky, smelling New York exhaust, one hand constantly playing pocket pool with his wallet to make sure it was still there. New York, thy name is Paranoia. Suddenly, where he wanted to be was in a West Coast recording studio, making a new album. Larry quickened his step and turned in at an arcade. Bells and buzzers jangled in his ears, and there was the amplified, ripping growl of a Death Race 2000 game, complete with the unearthly electronic screams of the dying pedestrians. Neat game, Larry thought, soon to be followed by Dachau 2000. They'll love that one. He went to the change booth and got $10 in quarters. There was a working phone booth next to the Beef and Brew across the street, and he direct-dialed Jane's place from memory. Jane's was a poker parlor where Wayne Stuckey sometimes hung out. Larry plugged quarters into the slot until his hand ached, and then the phone began to ring 3,000 miles away. A female voice said, "Jane's, we're open." "To anything?" he asked, low and sexy. "Listen, wise guy, this isn't..." "Hey, is this Larry?" "Yeah, it's me. Hi, Arlene." "Where are you? Nobody's seen you, Larry." "Well, I'm on the East Coast," he said cautiously. "Somebody told me there were bloodsuckers on me, and I ought to get out of the pool until they dropped off." "Something about a big party?" "Yeah." "I heard about that," she said. "Big spender." "Is Wayne around, Arlene?" "You mean Wayne Stuckey, haven't you heard?" "What would I hear? I'm on the other coast." "Hey, he's okay, isn't he?" "He's in the hospital with his flu bug. Captain Trips, they're calling it out here. Not that it's any laughing matter. A lot of people have died with it, they say. People are scared staying in. We've got 6 empty tables, and you know Jane never has empty tables." "How is he?" "Who knows? They've got wards and wards of people, and none of them can have visitors. It's spooky, Larry, and there are a lot of soldiers around." "On leave?" "Soldiers on leave don't carry guns or ride around in convoy trucks. A lot of people are really scared. You're well off out where you are." "Hasn't been anything on the news." "Out here, there's been a few things in the papers about getting flu shot boosters, that's all. But some people are saying the army got careless with one of those little plague jars. Isn't that creepy?" "It's just scare talk," he said. "There's nothing like it where you are?" "No," he said, and then thought of his mother's cold. And hadn't there been a lot of sneezing and hacking going on in the subway? He remembered thinking it sounded like a TB ward. But there were plenty of sneezes and runny noses to go around in any city. "Janie herself isn't in," Arlene was saying. "She's got a fever and swollen glands," she said. "I thought that old whore was too tough to get sick." 3 minutes are up. Signal went through," the operator broke in. Larry said, Coming back in a week or so, Arlene. We'll get together." "Fine by me. I always wanted to go out with a famous recording star." "Arlene, you don't know a guy named Dewey the Deck, do you?" "Oh," she said in a very startled way. "Oh, wow, Larry."
"What?"
"Thank God you didn't hang up. I did see Wayne just about 2 days before he went into the hospital. I forgot all about it. Oh, gee."
"Well, what is it?"
"It's an envelope. He said it was for you, but he asked me to keep it in my cash drawer for a week or so, or give it to you if I saw you. He said something like, he's goddamn lucky Dewey doesn't own it instead of him."
"What's in it?"
He switched the phone from one hand to the other. "Just a minute, I'll see." There was a moment of silence, then ripping paper. Arlene said, "It's a savings account book, First of California. There's a balance of, wow, just over $13,000. If you ask me to go somewhere Dutch, I'll brain you."
"You won't have to," he said, grinning. "Thanks, Arlene."
"Sure, I'll put it in an envelope with your name on it. Then you can't duck me when you come in."
"I wouldn't, sugar."
They hung up, and then the operator was there, demanding $3 for Ma Bell. Larry, still feeling the wide and foolish grin on his face, plugged it willingly into the slot. He looked at the change still scattered on the phone booth's shelf, picked out a dime, and dropped it into the slot. A moment later, his mother's phone was ringing. Your first impulse is to share good news. Your second is to club someone with it. He thought, no, he believed that this was entirely the former.
He wanted to relieve both of them with the news that he was solvent again. The smile faded off his lips little by little. The phone was only ringing. Maybe she had decided to go in after all. He thought of her flushed, feverish face, and of her coughing and sneezing and saying shit impatiently into her handkerchief. He didn't think she would have gone in. He hung up and absently removed his dime from the slot when it clicked back. He went out, jingling the change in his hand. When he saw a cab, he hailed it, and as the cab pulled back into the flow of traffic, it began to spatter rain. The door was locked, and after knocking two or three times, he was sure the apartment was empty. He had rapped loud enough to make someone on the floor above rap back like an exasperated ghost. But he would have to go in and make sure, and he didn't have a key. He turned to go down the stairs to Mr. Freeman's apartment, and that was when he heard the low groan from behind the door. There were three different locks on his mother's door, but she was indifferent about using them all in spite of her obsession with the Puerto Ricans. Larry hit the door with his shoulder, and it rattled loudly on its frame. He hit it again, and the lock gave. The door swung back and banged off the wall.